Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
This podcast contains elements that may be alarming to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
You are now listening to British Bears, Little Cry Podcast.
Right, Vanessa Frake Harris, welcome to the show. We are live, we are recording, we are live and kicking. How the hell are you?
I'm good, Stu. Thanks very much for inviting me to the British Murders podcast. I'm happy to be here and happy to chat.
It's a pleasure to have you on. So I managed to find a copy of your book. I was very cheeky when I messaged you. I tried to get myself a free little copy, but it did get published a couple of years ago. I found it on Amazon Prime Reading, actually. Did you know it's part of the Prime membership now that you can get a copy of that? Just if you're a member of Prime, you can read that on your Kindle.
Oh, I didn't know that. Thank you very much. I might put that on my social media for anybody who's interested.
It's worth doing. I don't know if that's a recent thing Prime have been doing. You can get certain books for free, but you're paying for Prime, so it's not 100% free. But
I'm pleased you haven't let Yorkshire down by getting a freebie.
Obviously, that's fine. So I've not finished it, admittedly, but I am a fair way through it, and I am really enjoying it. To confirm, it's called The Governor, and the subtitle there, The Unbelievable True Story of My Life Inside Britain's Most Notorious Prisons. Let's rewind a little bit and start from the start, because it's the start. You began in the prison service. Now, my maths here is where I'm getting this figure from, but I got 1986, am I right?
Yeah, 12th of May 1986 was my first day at Holloway Prison,
Okay. So before that then, how did you get into that? Because it's not your everyday kind of job, is it? A career counsellor at school? What do you want to be? I want to work in a prison. How did that come about?
Well, it's a bit of a long-winded story, and I'll try and make it as brief as I possibly can. But I originally wanted to join the forces. I wanted to join the Wrens. I wanted to be in the Navy, sail the seas, et cetera, et cetera. And on the 7th of the 7th, 77, I went for my interview, passed it. And then I found out that I'd be shore-based and that, like at that time, women weren't allowed on ships. So that put me completely off because I didn't want to be shore-based. I didn't want to do some mundane job in an office. I decided, well, my next step was agriculture. I love animals. I love being outside. So that's what I did for probably 4 or 5 years. Went to agricultural college, got an HND in agriculture, specialised in dairying, milked cows for a couple of years, had my own relief milking business where I milked cows for farmers that were on leave or sick, or the herdsmen, they were waiting for a new one, or any number of reasons. And that's what I did. And I really enjoyed it. Went around different farms, met different people. That was all fine. But I could see in the future there was really kind of nowhere for that to go. I wasn't going to, get on in life with that. Milk quotas were brought in by the European Commission, which basically meant that farmers were penalised if they produced too much milk, whereas before they'd been encouraged to make as much milk as possible. So the farmers saw a drop in their wage packet, and therefore I saw a drop in mine. So after that, I thought, well, what's plan B? And I was in London one weekend and I saw on a tube advert a sort of picture of a general kitchener said, your prison service needs you and you too can make a difference. And I thought, well, yeah, I'm pretty sure I could do that job. So I applied. But at the same time, I also applied for the Met Police because I quite fancied working for the Met. So that took about a year from the time that I applied to the actual time I was given a start date, which was, as you said, the 12th of May, 86. Then the training was you did four weeks at a chosen establishment. Mine was Holloway. And then you did 9-10 weeks up at the training school. Mine was in Rugby. There was also one in Wakefield. So that's what I did. And then halfway, I was in my training halfway up at Rugby, and I got a letter from the Met Police saying, congratulations, you've been accepted to the Met. You can start on this date at Hendon. And by that time, I was halfway through. I thought, oh, well, we'll see where this one goes. And I've always got that to fall back on. And the rest, they say, is history.
It's interesting that, isn't it? And kind of Sod's Law that you get into one because you don't hear from the other. And then when you're halfway through the first one,
it's kind of one of those sliding door moments, isn't it? What would have happened had it been the other way around? But, you know, we'll never know now. So
let's explore that a little bit, though. Let's play, you know, not devil's advocate, that's the wrong word. Let's just fantasize a little bit. Let's say you had joined the Met Police.
Yeah.
In a hypothetical world, where do you think that would have taken you? Because you're very ambitious, no nonsense, you don't take any shit. You probably would have risen through the ranks, even because people like Jackie Martin, for example, very strong woman, she rose through the ranks at a time when it wasn't common for that to happen. Do you think that would have happened with yourself? Would you have progressed as much as you did within the prison system?
I'd have liked to have thought so. Like you say, I'm the only reason I really kind of started with the whole going up the ladder was because we had a really crap senior officer when I was at Holloway and made some really bad and dangerous decisions. And I thought, geez, I'm sure I can do better than that. And that's why I went for promotion. And that sort of started the ball rolling. And then a lot of it was being in the right place at the right time. But as you say, like, you know, I once I got my teeth into something, I really kind of, I didn't excel at school. I hated school with a passion. I got dreadfully bullied. I always felt that there was something a little bit different about me, and school just wasn't the right environment for me. But something that I enjoy and I love, I can excel at. School just weren't one of those things, but, you know, that's how it was. But I would like to think that I would have gone as far as I could have in the Met Police. I certainly think that, you know, women in any kind of job like that had hoops to jump through far, far more than men. Jackie Moulton, a good friend of mine, is one of them. You know, she put up with a dreadful lot of misogyny, etc., in the Met Police in the middle 70s. And you know, sometimes you look at it and you think, well, actually has much changed? But, you know, the same could have been said for the prison service.
Yeah, I noticed you tweeted something when I was sort of stalking your profile, as it were, recently about the stuff Jackie went through and how it's still prevalent today. It's just bizarre to me that so many decades later stuff like that does kind of exist. Probably a conversation for a different time. But what I want to come back to is something you touched upon, is you mentioned that the senior officer there was making some quite dangerous decisions. Can you remember any of those decisions? What sort of thing are we talking about?
Well, we're talking like prisoners that were known violent, who were unlocked with very little supervision and allowed to assault other prisoners and officers. You know, some sort of unable to say no to prisoners, which, you know, I always found quite easy for some reason. But, you know, once you start saying yes all the time, you're getting yourself into a very sticky wicket situation. And those kind of situations can have ramifications for everybody else, you know, coming along afterwards.
you know, given the time you had at school was quite difficult, you mentioned that you got bullied there. I'm going out on a limb here, but do you think that played any role in you wanting to pursue a career in the prison service or the Met Police? Because the people that are locked up are, by definition, bullies, right? They've done something wrong for the most part. Some people are in there when it's a minor offence. But do you think your school life played any part in that, or am I overthinking it?
I think to a bit, Stu, I think you're actually kind of overthinking it a bit. If anything, you know, I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to make a difference to somebody's life. I mean, a lot of times, you know, with people who are convicted of crime, you know, it's there for the grace of God go I. And if you can help, I always thought, if I can help one person turn their life around, whatever that may be, and you say, you know, I'm quite strict. Well, yeah, I was fair, though. You know, I always get ensured prisoners got everything that they were entitled to, nothing more, nothing less. You know, and bullying in prison is quite prevalent anyways. And anything that you can do to keep prisoners safe, to keep staff safe, to keep visitors safe is in my book is a good thing. You know, it's not all about locking people up, being a prison officer. You know, that is like a very small part of your job. You know, you can wear, you know, 20 different hats in a day, you know, from counsellor to confidant to helper outer to, you know, nurse to any number of things rather than just unlocking and locking a door.
How does that differ based on what you expected? So, for example, in any job, we have a contract, right? And it says what your responsibilities are. In that role, it sounds like a lot of your responsibilities are unwritten, so informal responsibilities. How far removed from what you're actually expecting was the role, especially when you first started?
Oh, completely. I mean, nobody ever told me I'd see a dead body. Nobody ever told me that I'd have to deal with people with really severe mental health issues, you know, who were locked up in prison because there was nowhere else for them to be detained and protect the public, you know. But these are things that happen, you know, not just to me, but to prison staff on a daily basis. You know, you're expected to deal with quite horrendous self-harm issues, suicides, violence. You know, I think I was there 2 days and one of the officers I work with got quite badly assaulted, like in front of me. And I, you know, your instinct is to protect your colleagues, and you just like jump in like all guns blazing. She got hit. Sounds funny, but she got hit quite severely on the back of the head with a broom. And it literally just split her skull open. You know, there was like claret everywhere. And this was like, I'd only been there 2 or 3 days. You know, I mean, I didn't know what to do, only that I knew that I had to jump on this prisoner to stop her, like, carrying on beating the crap out of this officer. So, you know, although they try and prepare you for it and they, like, teach you interpersonal skills, you know, how to deal with somebody screaming at you, shouting in your face, somebody who won't talk at all, trying to sort of cajole them along, trying to get somebody to do something that they don't want to do, you know, all these sorts of things. Actually, when it comes to the nitty gritty, a lot of it you have to learn on the hoof, and you learn by experience, and you learn by watching other staff and watching their reactions and how they deal with situations. And at the end of the day, you kind of find your own niche as to how you deal with it and on what level you communicate with prisoners. You know, you may communicate with prisoners totally differently to how I do, but that may work for you, but it wouldn't work for me. You know, you have to find your own level, which can be difficult.
What's the turnover rate like, you know, for staff? Because I imagine, like, you've had a real baptism of fire there, and some people won't have the minerals, I guess, for better sake of a term, to get on with the job. Some people would choose the flight rather than fight mode, rather than jump on the colleague. They might stay back and think, you know what, this job isn't for me. Is there a high level of turnover for staff, or is it generally the people that apply typically have that mentality?
I think nowadays it's a very high level turnover of staff. You know, they can't actually recruit enough staff to fill the gaps because people are leaving. When I joined in an era where it was seen as a career for life. You know, I had no intention of doing anything else with my life apart from the prison service. Never, I can honestly say, hand on my heart, never actually crossed my mind once to leave the job. And I saw some pretty awful things, but it actually never crossed my mind. But unfortunately, you know, with how things are and how they've sort of sucked the money out of our prison system now, you know, a manager in McDonald's gets paid more than a new member as a prison officer who has to deal with violence on a daily basis. So, you know, now people look at it, young people look at it as, you know, a stepping stone. So you might get graduates coming out of university, staying 1 or 2 years and then moving on to something else. And that's not good for the service because they need experienced staff and they need consistency of experienced staff.
Sounds like a vicious circle, really. They need the staff that are experienced, but there's not the funding there. So they have to get someone in. So they get someone in who's inexperienced, doesn't have what it takes, they leave, repeat the cycle. So you spent 16 years at Holloway.
And I did.
You met some pretty notorious inmates in there. I'd like you to tell me the story, and it's only a short story, but it's so strange. And I know you've spoke about it in the media, but the one about meeting Mara Hindley for the first time. Can you tell me that one?
Okay. Well, I was a relatively new officer, maybe been in a year. I was detailed to take some prisoners from Holloway to Cookham Wood as part of an escort. Because that's what we did. Holloway was sort of a hub prison. So prisoners came in, were convicted, given a sentence, and then sort of dispersed around the country to various other prisons. So my job that day was to escort, I think we did 4 or 5 prisoners from Holloway to Cookham Wood, myself and 2 other officers. Because I was the most junior, I got sat at the back on the, we used to have these vans called pixie, we used to call them pixie vans. I don't know why, but if you were junior, you got shoved to the back and you were on the wheel arch, and it was the most uncomfortable position to be in. There was like springs sticking out everywhere. Anyway, so we cuffed the prisoners up. I was sat at the back, one officer was sat in the middle and one at the front, and the girls were fine. They knew that they were going off to Cookham Wood to start their sentences. Everything was fine. Got to Cookham Wood, and you know it's kind of a done thing. You know, when you have visiting staff to your establishment, you offer them a drinks, make sure that you know they're okay if they want like a bathroom break or anything. So the senior officer who met us in receptions at Cookham Wood shouted out Myra like that, and everybody sort of like just raised their eyebrows, and she says to us like, "Would you like a cup of tea?" So we were all, yeah, parched. So we said, yeah, absolutely, thanks. Anyways, this little old lady came shuffling out in sort of like old slippers and a sort of greeny-brown cardigan with holes in the elbows and sort of a few threads here and there, and the buttonholes had been clearly worn for a long time because the buttonholes had sort of stretched, and she had sort of like a denim skirt on, brown mousy short hair. Oh, honestly, I wouldn't have looked twice at her if I'd have seen her in the street. And she says, "Oh, Myra, get these staff a cup of tea, see what they want." So she sort of went round to us all, and she says, she got to me and she says, "Would you like a cup of tea?" And I said, "Yeah, absolutely, thanks, 2 sugars. She said, "Right, I'll be right back." And then the officer next to me, who was in charge of the escort, said to me, "You know who that was, don't you?" And I went, "Myra." And she said, "Yeah, but Myra who?" I was like, "I've no idea." And she said, "That's Myra Hindley." And I was like, "Yeah, all right." But, you know, whenever anybody ever thinks of Myra Hindley, they think of, you know, the bleach blonde, piercing eyes, you know, that photo of her. Well, honestly, she looked absolutely nothing like that. You wouldn't have noticed her. So she was clearly working in the receptions area where the staff were. And making drinks, and that's quite normal for prisoners to get jobs around the establishment. And I would imagine she got receptions because it was a small area, not much going on, a lot of staff, and she could be like kept an eye on. So she wasn't sort of like out in the rest of the population. Anyways, she came back with a tray, 3 cups of tea on it, said, "Here's yours." I said, "Thanks very much." She says, "Is there anything else I can get you?" I was like, "No, that's fine." And I drank the tea. That was it. But people like to make, I know it's because it's Myra Hindley, but people like to make a lot out of it. I never actually thought twice about it. Absolutely. What she did, you know, she deserved to be locked up for the rest of her life. I don't disagree with that at all. But prisoners like her and other prisoners that I've come across who are quite high profile, to me, they were always a prisoner. You know, they were never, I never gave them anything or looked at them anything different to any other prisoner. And, you know, I think it's important that people realise that they may be sort of high profile outside of jail, but actually inside of jail, they're nobody. You know, they're next to nothing. And that's how it is. I don't sit here and think, oh, you know, I know I went on Good Morning Britain and Alison Hammond says to me, "What, you actually drank the cup of tea?" And I was like, "Well, yeah, I was thirsty." You know, she was doing a job. You know, I like any prisoner, she could have spat in it. Yeah, of course she could. But so could anybody else who makes you a cup of tea. You know, that's just one of the things.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because that's the question most of the people listening are probably thinking. Like, as soon as you find out who she is, the last thing you're going to do is drink that tea, right? But as you say, once she enters those prison walls, she's just prisoner number XYZ or whatever. I did wonder, though, because seeing someone like that appearing normal, for better use of a word, knowing what they've done on the outside, granted they're on the inside and she's an old woman at that point, does that make it, you might not think about it like we do, but does that make it more terrifying that they can just appear so normal given what they've done?
I tell you what, but when you see, I mean, Myra Hindley, absolutely, what she did was unforgivable. And a lot of what she did didn't come out. A lot of it was still, like, kept in court dossiers. But there were other prisoners equally as vile, equally as heinous crimes as she committed. And if you let things like that get to you, you'd never be able to do your job. I looked at my job as my job was to make sure that they were safe, to make sure staff were safe, to make sure that, you know, we protected the public by keeping the likes of Myra Hindley et al. In jail behind those walls. My job wasn't to judge them because they'd already been judged by their peers, by our courts and by our justice system. So, you know, I think if you, I mean, yes, in certain cases you do have to know what prisoners are in for. With high profiles, well, of course, you could only have to open a newspaper and you can see what they're in for. But it's important that if you're working with people like that, those high profile prisoners who've done dreadful, dreadful things, that you don't latch on to that and let that become the focus. Because if you did, you're going to let your professionalism down because you wouldn't be able to be civil. You wouldn't be able to, you know, let me think how to put this that doesn't sound like, you know, I'm some soft touch, because I can assure you I'm not. But I wouldn't want to let anything get in the way of treating prisoners decently, regardless of what they've done. You know, I don't believe in going in and beating prisoners up. I don't believe in withdrawing anything that they're entitled to for no reason. I don't advocate any of that. But what I do advocate is prisoners getting what they're entitled to, and working with them to try and assist them to A, realise what they've done, B, address their crimes, and C, have empathy for the victims and the victims' families of those crimes. So to me, Myra Hindley could have been Joe Smith. Wouldn't have made any difference, you know, whoever it was that bought me that cup of tea. The media made it so that it was Myra Hindley, you know.
Yeah,
does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. Because whenever I've researched you, any interviews you've done, your career's absolutely fantastic, but the thing they've latched on to get clicks for that article is that cup of tea story with Myra.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, it's an interesting story, but it's such a minor part of your career. It almost kind of, oh, is she the governor that met Myra kind of thing? And it's like, it's just so much more than that. I've got a two-part question for you. The first one, I think I know the answer to. The first part is, what's your opinion on capital punishment? I think I know the answer to that based on what you've just said. The second one is, do you believe in rehabilitation? And if so, can that be achieved for everyone, or are there limits? So for people like Myra, probably not wise given what she did. I'm wondering what the limit is with that, if you do think rehabilitation is possible.
Okay. Capital punishment. I always used to say, yeah, I believe in it. Absolutely. I'd quite happily do death watch on somebody. It wouldn't bother me in the slightest. Somebody like Myra Hindley, Ian Huntley, you know, I wouldn't bat an eyelid. Absolutely. Because I think there are some things that go beyond humanity. And, you know, like I said, I'm no soft touch. But, and I have to put the but in there, as I've got older, maybe I've mellowed a little bit more. I still believe in capital punishment, but not to the extent I used to when I was younger. And I think that is probably, maybe I have mellowed a bit. Maybe after nearly 30 years, the other side, maybe I have. I don't necessarily think that the justice system in this country has it right in what we dish out as punishment. You know, the punishment, people need to remember that the punishment to any prisoner is the taking away of their liberty. That's their punishment. And keeping them locked up, that's to protect the public. So is that enough? I mean, people go mad when they see, you know, prisoners with PlayStations or with TVs. But those sorts of things, they're not a right. They're a privilege. And like all privileges, you know, they can be taken away. But if you're working with somebody, this sort of leads on to the second part of the question. If you're working with somebody and trying to rehabilitate them, because part of the prison service statement is to help people lead law-abiding and useful lives upon release. If you're working with somebody, not necessarily an all-time lifer like Huntley West, Myra Hindley, but people who have committed crime and who have been given a set sentence and will eventually be released. If you're working with those, you have to give them a carrot and a stick. You know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. If they want to engage with the reoffending, bus and get on board, then that's great. But some prisoners don't, you know, and you can't make. But like I said earlier, you know, if you've helped one prisoner to turn their life about and to be released and become a useful part of society, well, then that's a good thing. Reoffending in this country is one of the worst in Europe. We lock up more prisoners in this country than any of the prisons in Europe. So why is that? A lot of prisoners in this country are locked up for non-violent offences. That is a bugbear of mine, because that is clogging up our prisons with people who should be out in the community saying sorry for, you know, driving while drunk, or if they haven't, obviously if they've killed somebody, that's a whole different thing. But you know, shoplifting. You know, when I was at Holloway, we had a prisoner come in. A woman was sentenced to 6 weeks for stealing a British Rail sandwich. Personally, I think that was very brave of her. But, you know, was that justice? Was that was that a good use of our funds, our taxes, to lock somebody up for 6 weeks for nicking a sandwich? Come on. So I think, and then, of course, you've got people who have mental health issues who shouldn't be in prison. But, you know, what do we do with them? Where do we put them? There are no such things as mental institutions anymore. The whole ethos now is, you know, it's care in the community. Unfortunately, the community doesn't care. So these are all things that, as a society, I think we need to think about. We could do much better with reducing reoffending in this country, much, much better. But, of course, prisons aren't a vote winner, not by any stretch of it. Nobody's going to vote for somebody who says, I'm going to plough all our money into prisons and reducing reoffending. You know, that's just not going to happen. Certainly not in my lifetime. But people forget, you know, every prisoner place is around 50 grand a year. That's what our taxes are going on to keep people who really shouldn't be in prison in prison. So I think as a society, we need to have a good hard look at the justice system in this country. And I think it's certainly needs some major changes. But like I said, it's not a vote winner. So it'd be a very brave politician that stands up and says, well, I'm going to take this on. Because every single time we get a new government, regardless of which size and we get side, we or a new prisons minister, things change. So usually it's something, they bring in something we did 10 years ago. It didn't work then and it probably won't work now. So you just get this revolving door of policies that don't work. Every single one of them thinks they've invented the wheel, but they haven't, because we've usually done it before and it still doesn't work. And really the only thing that prisons need is an injection of cash. And, you know, that's, I don't know, with the cost of living crisis now, are people going to stomach that for committing crime and putting our cash into jails? I hardly think so.
Absolutely.
The story will continue after these quick messages.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
And now back to the story.
We'll just talk a little bit about aftercare. So let's say I got sent to prison. I got a 10-year sentence. Mm-hmm. I was a good boy. I got out in 5.
Mm-hmm.
On my, what do you call it when you, is it release day, right? I was going to say freedom day.
Yeah, yeah.
On the release day, I walk out into the yard. I've got my belongings and I walk out into the street. I'm a free man again. What's the aftercare like for me? Because my life has been inside a prison for 5 years. So if I had loans, they're in arrears, you know, I've got marks on my credit score, my job's gone, my life's gone. What's the aftercare like for me? Or am I just expected to sort it out myself? Because if not, I imagine that's why a lot of the reoffending happens.
Well, yes, to a point, but there are lots of charities that work within prisons, St. Mungo's, the Citizens Advice, various charities, homeless charities that work quite closely with prisons and come into prisons. And there are specific courses that prisoners can do when they've served like long sentences like that, that prisoners can apply for and do that help them to deal with all of that. So they have got somewhere to go. A lot of them will be on license, so they will have terms and conditions to adhere to. So it'd be like no drinking alcohol, no taking drugs, reporting to a probation officer. A lot of them will have got jobs already lined up. Because if you've got a 10-year sentence and you've been a good boy, chances are you'll be at an open jail. So hopefully you would have got a job in the relative community. I used to run a prison called Latchmere House, which was in southwest London. That was an open jail. We had 205 prisoners there. And out of that 205, about 199 went out every day to work and came back in the evening. So it was completely focused on reducing reoffending. But because it only had 205 places, the head office decided to close it because it wasn't viable. So, you know, we did all sorts of work there with offenders, with charities, with making sure prisoners on release had somewhere to live, had somewhere to work, had employers that understood the conditions of their license, you know, all sorts of things. We used to go out and we used to do checks on them to make sure that if they were working at, I don't know, the hairdressers down the road, that's exactly where they were, you know, things like that. But again, you know, they're expensive to run. You know, we wouldn't expect somebody just to be walk out the gate after a long sentence with nothing. You know, you do get a discharge grant, you get a rail warrant, depending on where you're going, you get all those sorts of questions that you've asked me should have been sorted out prior to your release.
Okay.
The difficulty comes when they're not, or whether they're discharged to, say, a hostel, and then they walk out the gate and then they don't go to the hostel. You know, they go somewhere else, or they have mental health issues and they're supposed to take their medication that is given to them to take with them and they don't, which happens, you know, I think there was something in the papers the other day about a prisoner who was a schizophrenic who didn't take his medication, was released out on license, and unfortunately went and stabbed several people with a couple of them fatally, which, you know, you never want to read about, because that is not how prisons should work. And there has to be a link between the prison and the community for those prisoners that are released to be managed. And it is a big thing. There's a big thing, a multidisciplinary thing called MAPA, which sort of covers police, probation, prisons, healthcare, you know, the whole sort of circle to manage prisoners on release.
Interesting. Before we go on to Wormwood Scrubs, I just want you to, I read this story about you were present when Rose West was informed that Fred had took his own life. What's that story?
Yes. Well, I was the senior officer in charge of the SEG. Now, Rose West was at Holloway for about 3 months on and off. I think it was about 3 months prior to her trial. Her trial was at Winchester Crown, but there's no female jail down at that area. So we kept her at Holloway for 3 months prior to her trial. And obviously, because she is who she is, and for her safety and others' safety, she was kept down in the segregation unit, which is also used as a punishment wing. So anybody who fails to comply with prison rules can be taken to the segregation unit, where they're segregated from the rest of the population, and that also includes those who are in fear, maybe in debt or being bullied, or, you know, they can ask for sort of segregation. So it's a unit, a small unit, where there are many different sort of facets to it. So we had Rose West down there, and one New Year's Day, about 5 o'clock, I was there, senior officer in charge. The governor came down to me, who was on duty, said, Fred West has, we've just heard from Winston Green that Fred West has killed himself. I need to tell Rose. I said, yeah, okay, no worries. So I opened the door. Rose was in her cell knitting. She was always knitting. Although we never quite found out what she was knitting, because it was like she just seemed to knit bizarrely. But anyways, So we opened the door, and I said to her, Rose, Governor's here. He's got something he needs to speak to you about. And she was like, oh, right, yes, yes. And Governor said, Rose, I'm very sorry to have to tell you that Fred has taken his own life. And she kind of looked like Rose had very thick glasses, and you could see that they were glass, not sort of plastic lenses, because they were almost like the bottoms of milk bottles. They were so thick. And I said, are you all right, Rose? You know, do you need a cup of tea? I doing sort of a care concern with her. And she's like, no, I'm fine. Thank you. Thanks for letting me know. Well, that was it. Nothing, no emotion, no sort of, no emotion, no sort of physically or mentally or, you know. And I always thought that Rose thought that because Fred was dead, that she thought that then there'd be nothing for her to answer to. And I do believe that Fred thought that as well, which is why he killed himself, to sort of get Rose off the hook. Well, unfortunately for Fred, that wasn't the case. And Rose got a whole life sentence, and well-deserved too. But I always felt that she was very good at, like a typical sort of psychopath, very, very good at hiding her emotions, literally having none on any subject, really. She was very sort of what I would call bland, very polite. Yes, no, thank you. No issue at all. But it was almost like you could see the sort of cogs working in the brain, which is sort of like a typical sort of psychopath, I think. She clearly thought that she was going to be free now, and I think she would have been quite surprised when she got her whole life sentence.
Yeah, I bet. Have you read the? I don't know if you read many books about these cases, given that you kind of knew prisoners in these high profile cases, but there was a book written by Mae West, one of her daughters, and it was when she was in prison and she was writing letters to her, and it contains the letters that she got back from Rose, and you can just kind of tell that there's almost a manipulation level there playing off as this victim mentality.
Oh, completely
blaming Fred for everything. It's a disturbing book. Yeah. I wouldn't recommend it if you're not into that kind of thing, that's for sure.
But interestingly, Myra tried to do the same. She tried to blame Ian Brady for everything too, you know. And I think that's almost a trait with sort of serial killers who are in a partnership. I think, you know, you say, like, have I read them? I haven't read that one, but I have read a couple of ones on Rose West. But I think it's interesting to see that it's always a bit like Bonnie and Clyde, you know, the woman always blames the man, but actually quite often the woman is manipulative and psychopathic in her own right, which I always sort of raise a bit of a smile at.
Yeah. No, you're right. That's what I've come across anyway, the ones I've researched. Let's talk about Wormwood Scrubs then. So you got sort of transferred there out of the blue, right?
Yep.
It was early 2002. And all of a sudden, March. So you've gone from this female-only prison at Holloway to Wormwood Scrubs, notorious male violent prisoners in there. What did you feel when you first heard that news? And secondly, how was that adjustment period from one extreme to the other?
When I first got the news, I was a bit gutted, but then we're mobile grades and we were always told we were mobile grades and, you know, you went where you were told to go. There wasn't really anything to do about it. And, you know, I hadn't specifically wanted to work with women prisoners. It had just sort of happened that way. When I applied for the job, because at that stage there were no cross-sex postings, so men worked at male establishments, females worked at female establishments, and Holloway was so short of staff, I was told, don't bother applying to any other female jail, you're going to Holloway, and that would be the end of it. Fair enough. So when I got the transfer notice to Wormwood Scrubs, I wasn't unduly worried that, you know, I was more concerned about, right, well, that's in West London. I knew roughly where it was. I've lived in London now for 17 years or so. But I'd never, and of course, I'd seen like the iconic towers on various, you know, cop programs, etc., and the Italian job and all that. So I knew a little bit about it. There, as far as I was concerned, there were worse places I could have been transferred to, like Brixton or Pentonville, which were sort of much, although they were Victorian prisons, were much more run down than Wormwood Scrubs was. And in a way, I quite was looking forward to the challenge. I kind of thought, well, you know, you've got to look at these things with a positivity. You know, I can't be doing with people that moan about a job. You know, there's the door. If you don't like a job so much, go and find another one. So I've never been like one to like sort of mess around like that. So I thought, well, we'll see how it goes and look at it as a new chapter. And that's what I did. And the morning I walked in there, I said to the gate staff, "Hi, Senior Officer Frake here. I'm the new SO starting at Scrubs." And they were like, "Who are you? We haven't got anything down that we're expecting. Hadn't got a clue." You know, typical communication or lack of in the prison service. But that was nothing new. You know, the left hand often doesn't know what the right's doing in the prison service, unfortunately. Communication skills amongst prisons, not prison staff, is pretty poor, really. But you know, I was told I was going to the lifer wing, 244 life sentence prisoners. I won't say I was scared. I was more apprehensive. I've never worked with male prisoners. I knew that they would be totally different, and I wasn't wrong. And I was very pleasantly surprised, incredibly pleasantly surprised, actually. In fact, you know, if I had my choice again today with my career, I'd have opted for a male jail any day of the week if I could have. I found men much easier to work with, much more, a bit like me, really, much more sort of straightforward. There's no sort of grey areas. It's yes or no. You say, no, you can't have that, or no, you can't do that. All right, Gov, no worries. You say that to a woman, and she go, yeah, but why not? It's like, and then you have to go like through reams and reams as to know why you can't do that, have that, whatever. And I found most of them were quite very respectful to the female staff. In fact, several times I had male prisoners step in when, you know, some prisoner was giving me a mouthful or something and say, you know, don't speak to the SO like that. Don't speak to the governor like that. You know, several times, you know, there's almost that sort of chivalry thing. But it was different, and it was a challenge without a doubt. But I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I can honestly say the saddest day of my life was when I retired from Wormwood Scrubs. You know, the staff were amazing. The building was just sort of, Holloway was built in the 70s. The old Holloway, where Myra Hindley originally went to, was knocked down, and this sort of almost like a mental asylum was built in its place in the 70s. It had sort of blind corridors and dorms, and it was much more like a hospital than a prison. But Scrubs was what I expected a prison to be. You know, a lot of gates clanging, banging, and netting on to stop prisoners falling from the fours down to the ones, and you know what I expected. Or saw in my mindset a prison to be. And I was delighted, actually, to be part of it.
Now, I hate to put you through reliving this story, but I read about an incident with something known as potting.
Yeah.
Which is a term I'd never heard. And looking at it, I'm glad I had never heard of it. But what happened with that?
Well, I was, what was I then? By then I was a principal officer, so that's up again. And I was still on the lifer wing. And a couple of days previous, one of the lifer prisoners, I was chatting to him about something or other. And he said, look, boss, just watch your back. And I was like, well, what do you mean watch your back? He says, I can't say any more than that. just be careful, watch your back. And I was like, right, okay, cheers. And there was a specific prisoner on there that, I mean, you're always going to have one or two that, you know, don't toe the line, you know, don't want to conform, have an issue with you, whatever. You know, and never unduly particularly worried me. Anyways, this particular prisoner, I'd said no to him about something. He clearly was unhappy with that. Anyways, one evening, I was in my office on the bottom landing, and an alarm bell went off. And as I came out of my office to run to where the alarm was, I was running along the corridor, and then next minute I was just drenched. And straight away, you know, you've been potted. And potting is it's a mixture of feces, urine. They keep it a couple of days, shake it up, put it in a plastic bottle, and then just lob it. It's possibly one of the worst things that could probably happen to you. It's done to humiliate you, to completely sort of, I don't know, dehumanize you almost. Like I said, I knew straight, it just literally covered me. I shouted to the rest of the staff to bang the wing up. Because the alarm had gone off, other staff had come from other wings, and we got the wing locked up. And the duty governor came, and he said, you need some new uniform. I said, absolutely. And he took me to the uniform store, and I got a whole set of uniform and that. And then I went to one of the showers at the gym. The PEI showers, went at a shower, put my uniform on, and went back to the wing. And it took a couple of days, but I went and saw this prisoner who'd said to me, watch your back. And I persuaded him to tell me who it was. I had a feeling I knew. Anyways, his feet didn't touch the ground. He was whisked off to the SEG, and then he was transferred very far up north. It's a bit like falling off a horse. You've just got to get back on it as soon as and get on with it. These things happen. It's very unpleasant. I won't deny that. But somebody from the Prison Officers Association, that was our union, said you can get $2,000 for that. You know, if you do like the compensation route. And I was like, I'm not really interested. I just crack on. I'm not bothered about that. But he was a good union guy, so I can't knock him for that. But I've been threatened. I've been assaulted. Some guy offered to, who was a double hitman. He shot two people. Threatened to have me shot outside the jail. Told me how easy it was. And, you know, if you took everything that people said, all the threats, etc., on board, well, you'd never come out of your house. You know, you've just got to deal with it and be able to deal with it and front it out most of the time.
Yeah, I get why you'd want to put that in the past and not drag it up through a compensation procedure or whatever that would entail. Let's pretend, before we move on to your sort of post-prison life, let's pretend it's my first day at Wormwood, okay? You're the governor there. Okay. I've done whatever I've done. What can I expect? So it's day one. My sentence has been handed. You're at prison. This is where you're going. I enter the door. Talk me through what happens on that initial stage.
Okay, so the first member of staff, well, from the court to the jail, you'll be taken by Security Corps or one of the private escort companies, GOAME, Security Corps, Group 4, is untold of them. And then you'll be rocked up to the jail. You'll open the door and you'll go straight into receptions. The first person you'll see will be the officer in charge of receptions, and he'll go through your warrant. So every prisoner has a warrant. If you don't have a warrant, you don't come in. We can only hold you in prison legally if we have a warrant. So if they've left your warrant at court, unfortunately, you'll be getting back on the van and going back to the court to get the warrant, because we legally cannot hold you without that bit of paper. And that bit of paper says your name, your date of birth, what you were charged with, what your sentence was if you've been convicted, and the date, and it's signed. It's signed by the clerk of the court. And if all of those things match with you, then you'll be allowed in. So it's important that, you know, A, you understand why you're there, that you've committed whatever, and that your sentence is whatever. Then you'll be go through to another desk who will go through various questions about you. So your religion, your address outside, your next of kin, emergency contacts. Because quite often prisoners come in and, of course, their mobile phones, etc., have all been taken off them. So, like, I know, like, my emergency contact, I won't have a clue what their number was. It's a mobile number. So, mm-hmm. obviously, like, it's important that prisoners are asked that question so that while they're there, we can get their mobile out, get them to get it out of their mobile, and so we can write it down. So that happens there. Then you're offered, if you're convicted, you have to wear a prison uniform. So your civilian clothes are taken from you and you're given a prison uniform, which is like a grey tracksuit nowadays. Yeah. Make sure that you have the right shoes, like hobnail boots, things like that are not permitted. So if you have hobnail boots, they'll be coming off and you'll be given like trainers. Make sure you have enough underwear and then offered a hot meal. Before I'll just miss a bit out, but before you're given your change of clothes, you're given a strip search. So it's top first, put clothes on, then bottoms, and then put clothes on in front of two male officers. And then you're offered a hot meal. And you go into a waiting room. And then from that waiting room, a nurse will call you out. You'll see healthcare. Your entire medical history will be gone through, including, you know, any attempts at suicide, any sort of ailments that you need medication for, asthma, whatever, heart complaints, whatever. And then you'll see a GP, the on-duty GP, who will also go through your health history, make sure if you've got any concerns that they're sorted at that time. Then from there, you'll be taken up to the first night center. Now, the first night center in prisons have worked really hard over the last sort of decades or couple of decades or so to improve the first night procedures. So what they've tried to do is to make it more or less like a prison cell and more like a place where it's not so scary for first time prisoners. So there you'll be offered a phone call to whoever you want. You'll be offered various PIN numbers so you can have your own phone account. If there's any concerns, if you share a cell with other prisoners, i.e., if you're a far right or far left or whatever, and object to whatever sharing a cell with, we wouldn't put you in a cell say you were homophobic, wouldn't put you in a cell with a known gay prisoner. Do you know what I mean? So that sort of thing. And that's pretty much your first night procedures in a sort of very condensed way. The first night center also has cameras so that they can sit not in toilets, but in cells so that they can monitor first night prisoners. Because obviously, you know, if you've just got a 15-year sentence for whatever, you know, it can be quite a shock to an individual, regardless of how hard they think they are or how tough they think they are. It can be quite a scary place for prisoners. So that's the first night procedure. The following day, you'll probably move from the first night centre to an induction wing where you'll be inducted on any number of things. So you have to have a basic level of reading, writing, and maths. And if not, then you'll go to the education department. You can enrol for the gym, for work courses, for various things pertaining to each individual prison, you know, whatever they sort of specialise. And convicted prisoners are required to work. So you can't say, I don't want to work, because you can't. It's not conforming to prison rules. If you're convicted, then you must work.
Right.
And that's it.
Wow. It's interesting. I didn't realize there was such an induction process, but it makes sense as to why, especially if, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very vulnerable time for, for prisoners.
Yeah. So you retired in 2013.
Yep.
You mentioned it was a sad day when you made that decision. Married your partner, Julie, in 2014.
Yep.
Which is lovely. And then you're sort of working now. You're doing a bit of baking, right? From working as a governor.
I know it's a bit of a turnaround, isn't it? But I've always loved cooking. I love cooking. My nan taught me to cook, when I first retired, I kind of lost my way a bit. I kind of felt that, you know, for the first couple of weeks, it's like you're on holiday, isn't it? But then it starts to become daily, and then you kind of lose you almost. It's like, well, what do I do now? You know, I had this really high stressful, high profile job dealing with sort of, you know, prime ministers and God knows who else, to nothing. And I thought, well, I'm going to have to do something. I can't just, you know, clean house all day and walk dogs. I need to fulfill my life somehow. So I started cooking at home, and we moved to a place called Saffron Walden in Essex, and they had a really nice cafe there, did all my sorts of things, and sort of used all sort of local produce. And I thought, oh, I could possibly get a little job there. Quite fancy that. A little part-time job, that'd do me. Anyways, that's exactly what I did. I started baking, and I never looked round. And I still bake now. I don't work there anymore once COVID hit and I got furloughed from that, and then that closed. So, but in all fairness, you know, I don't really have that much time these days. I'm busy doing other things, which, you know, the book has led me down paths that I never thought. When I wrote the book, I didn't think that, you know, anybody would be that interested in it. But how wrong was I? You know, from that, you know, I do talks. I do filming on Friday for a TV program. I do radio broadcasts. I do podcasts. You know, the list is just endless. And I'm very grateful. Very grateful. So it's like completely, you know, turned my life around into something that I never ever imagined would happen.
Cool. Well, as a reminder, that book is called The Governor, and it came out in April 2021. Harper Nonfiction, the publisher on there. Vanessa, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your insight. You. It's fascinating. Could talk for hours about it, I won't lie, but I want to leave some people, you know, the chance to buy your book and read the actual stories on there. Where can people find you? Socials, social medias?
I'm on Instagram, I'm on Twitter, I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on Facebook. Just give me a shout. I'm happy to chat.
Cool. Well, I hope you all enjoyed that. Thanks again for your time, and I'll see you all next time.